I'm just glad to be here. As many of you know, I was away on study leave this past week in Denver, and guess which airline I flew with? American Airlines, yep. One of my flights going was canceled and had a little bit of a rigmarole, and then all week I heard every day another 500 canceled, another 300 flights canceled, and I'm thinking, boy, you know what? I might not see the weekend in Ottawa. And so I followed the news, and sure enough, my flights had been canceled. There was a mad scramble to get me on another airline, and then that didn't work, and then on another airline. Good old Air Canada got me home. So there you go. I'm glad. Late, but late, but here. I was thinking as I was in Denver that about my colleague, Peter Lahid, over at Emmanuel, and at Easter he was in Nicaragua, I think it was, or Guatemala, if I'm not mistaken, on part of a mission trip and was to be back for Easter Sunday, no less, and his plane did not get him back. Can you imagine just not being there for Easter? So, you know, as pastors, we love to be with our family. We love to be with our church family and enjoy the fellowship of worship and grace indeed. So I'm glad to be here. I wanted to begin with an apology. Not to you. Not yet. The time, I still have some time, so not yet. An apology to sheep. I have for a long time always understood and thought and even spoken and preached about sheep as being dumb. You've heard me say that, right? I want to apologize to sheep. If any of you own sheep, pass on my apology. If you see a sheep, pass on my apology. I came across some research that was reported on the National Public Radio while I was in Denver that was done in England. And this research is very interesting. It says, lowly sheep have gotten a bum rap. The conclusion of a new study on sheep by British scientists who say the easily herded creatures may be smarter than originally thought. The study published in the journal Nature describes research at Babram Institute in Cambridge, southern England. In the research project, sheep were shown pictures of other sheep and they were rewarded with food if they moved toward a selected image. As it turns out, the sheep quickly learned to recognize the faces that produce reward and discriminated between the face of another sheep that did not produce reward. The research showed that the sheep got it right 8 times out of 10. And the research also showed that they could remember the faces for an extended period of time. Some sheep could remember as many as 50 images of those faces for up to 2 years. And the study concluded that, like humans, sheep have special systems in their brain to discern between faces that are similar in appearance and to make distinctions in those. And the results also suggest that sheep have a very good memory of systems that are good at recognizing faces and the signs of higher intelligence, says Dr. Keith Kendrick, one of the authors of the study. So he says that the reason that sheep may have a reputation for little intelligence is that they seem to be scared about just about everything. And any animal, including humans, he wrote, when they are scared, they don't tend to show signs of intelligent behavior. Sheep are intelligent. I am sorry, sheep. So when Jesus describes us as sheep, it may be that we should resist the temptation, maybe that has been the case, to dismiss that pastoral image, to resist the temptation, well, I'm not dumb, so that means I can't be a sheep, and to realize that really what Jesus may be talking about is to be wise and discerning and distinguishing as sheep. So with apologies out of the way, we all are sheep, and though we may have gone astray, it may be because we too, like the sheep, are filled with fear. And that is the point at which our readings insert themselves into our lives and into our faith. The first reading that I want to draw attention to is one that is so well known that sometimes we just pass over the references. And what I love about this particular psalm, Psalm 23, are the wonderful directions and the deep vistas that may be plumbed for meaning and for inspiration. It is a wonderful psalm, and continually I'm amazed at what can be discovered in the psalm when you come to it afresh. Yes, we know how it begins. The Lord is my shepherd. And so what we begin to recognize as we read this psalm is the nature of shepherd care. What are the distinguishing marks of God's care meted out to us as shepherd to the sheep? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. It's a declaration of belonging and covenant. It's a declaration of intimacy. It's a declaration that God will supply the needs. That my security is not built on the accoutrements and the assembling of all those things materially and otherwise that we are led to believe will secure us. Better alarm systems, higher gates, more structurally reinforced cars with side window curtain airbags. We have promises of security all around. The psalmist cuts through that and simply says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And so what we're given, and I want to share with you what I believe are some of the gifts of shepherd care. And the first is a gift of trust. And trust is an antidote to fear. Remember what the study said about sheep. That sheep, like human beings, when they are afraid, they do stupid things. That is why we remind ourselves in our scriptures, and the scriptures remind us throughout, do not be afraid. 365 or 366, depending how you count them, references in the Bible to that phrase, don't be afraid. We need to be reminded of that every single day, like the sheep, because if we are gripped by fear, we tend not to exhibit the most intelligent of responses. And so it is a gift of trust that this shepherd care is bestows upon us, a gift of intimacy and harmony. It is an antidote to being mistrustful, to being suspicious and anxious, cynical, all those things indeed that erupt from our fear. And so when we hear the psalmist saying, the Lord is my shepherd, we are given the gift of trust. And it is. It is a lonely world to live a life where you do not trust anyone or anything. It's a miserable world. And so the gift of trust is transformative. It is radical. We also have the gift of provision. Sheep need three things in order for their well-being to be observed. They need good pasture land. They need adequate water, but still water. In other words, sheep are frightened of rushing water. And they also need safe paths. They need to be assured of safety. They need to belong. If there's conflict in the herd, in the flock, they don't get along well. They don't settle well. They don't lie down. Sheep do not lie down and rest until there's a sense of peace among the flock. The psalmist affirms and asserts that the shepherd gives these things, that God gives this in the form of shepherd care, trust and provision. God also gives a gift of protection and accompaniment. The terrain and the topography where this imagines shepherd life and sheep life, the arid terrain, as well as those deep valleys. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, those valleys with the shadows were perfect places for the prey, for animals to jump out and attack the sheep, or robbers, or thieves, or others. Protection is offered in the form of a rod and a staff. The rod was a mace-like stick, piece of wood, in which nails or pieces of metal were drummed in, and it was used to protect. And the staff was a little crook that would be used to guide the sheep or to hook them out of deep crevices when they fell over a precipice. The gift of accompaniment, the gift of provision, shepherd care comes into our lives, does not leave us on our own. This is what the sheep says. This is what we are invited to say. Even though all of this threatening reality is around me, I will not be afraid. I will fear no evil. Why? Not because I'm strong and tough, not because I can secure my own life, not because I have all the necessary alarm systems and protection around me. I will fear no evil. Why? Because thou, God, you are with me. The ultimate confidence is placed in the one whose care and accompaniment is truer than anything we know. You are with me. Shepherd care also includes the gift of hospitality and healing. And here's an insight that came to me as I was pondering this in my hotel room this past week. I hadn't thought of this before. It just came to me. The worship in the context of the conference, I think, probably had something to do with it. But although we can imagine the shepherds, and the shepherd would take the sheep out to pasture land, and one way of understanding this reference is, thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies, that the shepherds would go and preparing the table, they would find a plateau area, and they would look for the poisonous weeds and roots and so forth that the sheep sometimes do not distinguish well, and they would pluck them out, so they would prepare a certain area for grazing. And that's what is meant, preparing a table in the presence of my enemies, as well as the threatening forces that may come as animals, so they could graze in peace. But then I got to thinking about table, and I got to thinking about hosting, and what is the dominant metaphor and the dominant reality that would have been a part of that shepherd's world. It is clear that it was understood, certainly a patriarchal society, but it would have been obvious to those who read this first, that when you talk about you prepare a table in the presence of my enemies, it is a wonderful image for God as woman. For it was the women who prepared the table. Women who cultivated hospitality in that society. The shepherd, when they returned home, even though they were itinerant, in every village, in every community, it was the women who prepared the table, who prepared all of that that was needed. And I love that image. It turns. God is like a woman who prepares a table in the presence of mine enemies and hosts me with abundance, and all of us, so that we may eat and we may be satisfied with those things that are needful for life. God give in shepherd care the gift of hospitality and of healing. The oil that we use to anoint the children today is also a symbol of healing. And so the shepherd gives healing as well. And finally, in terms of shepherd care, we also are given the gift of eternal presence of God, the eternal presence of God in the form of goodness and mercy. Goodness and mercy shall pursue, not follow. It's a more active verb in Hebrew, shall pursue us. So that sounds nice. And we could actually stop there and feel very good and go home and say, boy, I feel so well taken care of by God. That feels wonderful. But you see, it doesn't end there. The readings do not. They insist that we receive, we celebrate those gifts of God, the gifts of shepherd care, in ways then that propel us outwards. So when we come to the reading in John, Jesus uses mixed metaphors in that, and the people are not quite comprehending what he is saying. I am the good shepherd. I am a gate. I am the true shepherd indeed. Here's what we need to understand. A true story that I heard from someone visiting in the Middle East met an Arab shepherd who was not familiar with the scriptures of the Christian scriptures. And he was describing what his life was like. And this gave this particular commentator an insight into how to understand this particular text in John. He was describing how he gathered and erected a pen at night for the sheep to go in. And he made sure as he checked them as they went in, if there was anything wrong, if there were any scratches or bruises, that he would have to apply some balm and healing for the night. And they gathered them in. And then he was describing, and then but there's an open gap in the gate. There's no gate. You don't have any wooden gate. You don't close it off. They could just get out. And the Arab shepherd said, no. I lie down across the mouth of the pen. And he said, I am the gate. The sheep will not walk over me. And any threat that comes has to get by me first. Jesus says, I am the gate. Enter through this gate. My sheep know my voice. The care that was articulated in the psalm continues in this particular gospel, as a way to propel us and focus in all that Jesus did by example and by teaching to what we read of in Acts. Now, here's the tricky part, and I want to alert you to the fact that it gets a little bit more uncomfortable from here on. So if this is where you have enjoyed the comfort and maybe want to tune out a little bit, well, I'm giving you fair warning. When we come to Acts, and we saw a hint of this in the adapted version of Psalm 23, when we read that familiar psalm, we begin to recognize that there are movements that are larger than the focus of the psalm. It begins to move us. We read in that psalm about children who know war, children who know suffering and lack of protection. And so the way in which both the psalmist and Jesus and the community of Acts imagines that God's care, God the shepherd who is coming, an accompaniment and grace and peace among those who are sheep, the way in which that is experienced and celebrated is through us. We then become, you see, sometimes we tend to think of ministers or priests as shepherds, and we use that language, shepherds of a flock. Well, you know, the truth of the matter, that's not true. I'm not really a shepherd at all, because there's only one true shepherd, and no others need apply. And so all of us are intended to be recipients of the care of the one true shepherd, Jesus, and to move in directions. When we see what is happening in Acts, the community comes together, they bring their possessions, they lay them at the disciples' feet, and it's distributed, and all have what they need. Now we read that and we think, oh, that's utopian, or maybe that's just a membership flyer to get people in. It never really happened. Even most scholars will tell you it didn't work. It was an experiment that worked for a short time, but then it didn't happen, because in the early church we see conflict coming after. But there was a time when the people moved by the shepherd care, who is Jesus, the example, began to imagine their lives differently. They remembered Psalm 23. They remembered that because the Lord is my shepherd and I shall not want, they remembered that fear dispelled creates an openness and a freedom and a wild abandon in order to risk one's possessions and one's life for the betterment of others. And they remembered that. They were inspired by that. If only for a moment in history, so we would think, so that they brought their possessions, they sold their land, and they distributed it to everyone who had need. And the Bible says no one was in need. Utopian? Not today. We couldn't do that today. The truth of the matter is that it was not only at that moment. The history of Christianity details and shows us that this went on and it continues to this day in ancient and modern times. I want to read for you some examples from our ancient writings around this. Just a generation after what Luke has written, the theologian Justin Martyr, in the second century, he summarized the appeal of the Christian community. So remember, this is early on in the first century, but in the second century, we see it still going on, this so-called momentary experiment. Justin Martyr, one of the church fathers, wrote, "We who once took most pleasure in accumulating wealth and property now share with everyone in need. We who hated and killed one another and would not associate with people of different tribes because of their different customs, now, since the coming of Christ, live familiarly with them and pray for our enemies." Does that sound familiar? Jesus said, love your enemies. Jesus came to be a reconciling force. Jesus came to propel us into the lives and the needs of others, to be extensions of that shepherd care. It's still going on in communities of faith. In the third century, Tertullian wrote about Christians, that why Christians are well known and well deserving of the reputation for socioeconomic generosity and building bridges. He wrote, "Our care for the derelict and our active love have become our distinctive sign before the enemy. See, they say, how they love one another and how ready they are to die for each other." The third century. The fourth century, it continues. The pagan emperor, the Roman Empire, Julian the Apostate, who was raised a Christian but renounced his Christianity and vehemently opposed Christians and started to strip them of their rights. Indeed, this is what he wrote almost disparagingly as a backhanded compliment. He called them godless Galileans, those who followed Jesus. He called them godless Galileans. "They feed not only their own poor, but ours also. Those who belong to us look in vain for our help that we should render to them." It goes on. And the point that I want to make is this, that seeming utopian example is something by which the people of God, in remnant form, because they all didn't do it, we know the huge wealth that the church has amassed and so forth, and there may be a place for that if it is used for the purposes of blessing the world. But there's a remnant that has continued from the time of Jesus and that early community, because they remembered these words. The Lord is my shepherd. the Lord provides. The Lord renders me unafraid in the plight and in the face of danger. I am to love my enemies. I am to care for the poor. I am to seek justice. I am to spend my life for the benefit of others. They remembered, and they host a remnant of memory for the Christian community down through the ages. It was the church that first established the asylum, as it were, when people of disadvantage or learning difficulties or various kinds of psychiatric ailments were being disparaged and beaten down. It was the church that established a safe place where they could be cared for. It was the church community in the years of cycle of disease, when they would come every 25 years and people would flee from the cities. It was the Christians who stayed and cared for the sick and buried the dead, and they themselves would die. But over time, we read from looking at where Christians are buried that they lived longer because they built up an immunity. It was Christians that established the first hospitals. Christians established public education for everyone, not only the elite. It was the church that had remembered, and that remnant hosted the radical way of engaging life and spending your life for others because they remembered the shepherd's care. Shepherd care leads to abundant giving and spending of one's life. On the way back on this flight that I wasn't supposed to be on but got on, I found it a great privilege. You know, I tell you about stories of sitting beside people and gets around to, well, what do you do? What do you do? Yeah, I'm a minister. Oh, a wonderful conversation ensued. I sat beside a young woman from Southwest Ontario, about 26, I would guess around 26 years old, a young up-and-coming professional who was down in Denver on business, training transportation systems, people in use of transportation systems and technology, mathematician and IT support and that sort of thing. And we got to talking about a variety of things. I was reading a book about the conference of the emerging church and how young people in this generation in North America and around the world are beginning to discover new ways of expressing their faith, and they're disengaged and disenfranchised by the established church, but are finding ways in continuity with the Christian faith to live in community relationally and in the areas of poverty and giving their lives in that way. And she was curious about that. And we got to talking. She said, you know, I was raised in United Church and there were some important lessons and so forth there, but it didn't really take. And now I don't attend. You know, the hustle and bustle of corporate life in New York, in Toronto and so forth. But then she said, I asked her a series of questions. I said, help me, because I want to learn from you and learn about what role the church plays and what it could play and how could it appeal to younger people and what's going on in your life and your cohort of people that you know. And we came to the point where she said that she was deeply grieved right now by friends of theirs who was going through difficult times. There was a couple that was struggling with infertility. And they had a series of miscarriages. And they concluded, how could there be a God and cause us to lose so many children? And she said, you know, I've been away from the church a long time and so forth. And I didn't go in there to tell them give them some answers. But I've been praying for them. I've been going to see them and supporting them and encouraging them and just being there to listen and present to them. And as we began to talk, she said, you know what? I just realized from our conversation that it's the kind of care that I received in the community and in that church, in the youth group, and the things that I heard that are probably behind us. I never put that together. Why I stick it out even though I find a way to absorb the anger of that couple, my friends that I care about so much. And can't seem to see their way out. Shepherd care, even unacknowledged, is at work in her and brings her present in the lives of people in real life. The early community of faith, down through the ages, in maybe large historic ways, but also quiet moments of friends being friends, neighbors being neighbors, using your life to be an example of what it means to live in gratitude for the care that we have received from our good shepherd God. blesses and transforms the lives of others. From shepherd care to abundant giving. It is not a zero-sum equation. There's enough and more to go around. Your life, your resources, my life, my resources. My time, my money, my prayers, my faith, my friendship is meant to be given away so that all will have their needs met. Shepherd care of God extended to all through us. Amen.